Hey, I'm Russell Leeds, and welcome to the Property Investors Podcast. On this week's show, we're going to be discussing the biggest mistakes that newbie property investors make. So I've brought with me someone who knows all about making mistakes. Chase,
Thank you for that introduction, Russell. Thank you. I'm good at you.
That is all right. No problem. Well, yeah. They always say, don't they? You either learn from making mistakes or you learn from someone else's mistakes.
Correct.
So I thought, bring James on the show.
Let everybody learn from my mistakes.
He's made every mistake in the book. I mean, look at the haircut for a start. So I thought, you know, you'd be a great person to bring on for this week.
Thank you, mate. Thank you.
So we've made a list. We've sat down. We've made a list of what we believe to be the top 10 mistakes that beginner property investors make. And while property investing can be incredibly lucrative and is obviously a fantastic way of making money, you can lose a lot of money as well if you make some of these mistakes.
Yes, definitely.
So I think it's well worth going through them.
I'm sure you've lost some money as well, Russell.
I actually have lost money on one investment that I've made. I've lost money on, but it wasn't
we
really
are even
property.
Stevens. I'm on one.
You're
it
on one.
A big one, but one still the same. So
mine wasn't much. I've lost $3,500.
What were that way?
So it kind of was property. It was a company that offered it was a crowdfunding company. And they were doing like, you know, you'd put a bit of money in. I was doing it more of an experiment, but you kind of put a bit of money into it and then they give you like a 12% return on your money.
You put the money in then?
I put the money in. It worked for years and I was getting my money back. So I say I've lost $3,500. I probably made, and it wasn't putting big amounts in. I was playing with about $15,000, just experimenting with it. I probably made that $3,500 in interest over the years. But then suddenly I noticed, because I had lots of deals on there, and I noticed that a lot of the deals were like late paying back. And I thought, that's a bit of a red flag. Mm. You know, they were like, oh, this deal's not, and it's like not even a bit late, like 6 months, a year late. I was thinking, they can't keep going like this. So I tried to pull all my money out.
Yeah.
I got about $10,000 out, and then suddenly the company went bankrupt. I'd left about five in. And then over the years, every now and again, they release a little tiny bit more money. So I might get it back.
That's a lesson for being lazy and not investing yourself, really, isn't it?
So that's the first. There's 11 now. 11. You know, don't be lazy. It's rule number one. All right. Well, let's move on to the real number one, stroke number two. And this, interestingly, is probably the opposite of what most people think, but it is the biggest mistake that I actually see. And it's people are too cautious trying to find the perfect deal.
Yeah, I used to do this a lot. And I still do a little bit, because when you get a couple of like real banging deals, you then everything else has got to live up to that, hasn't it? And it's difficult to always find a banging deal, especially when the market's so up and down. You can never replicate it, can you?
No.
Or it's difficult to anyway. I'm guilty of that.
Being too cautious.
Yeah, trying to find the perfect deal. But that goes back to when you've been bit, doesn't it? Because if you've been bit a little bit, sometimes then you're like, ooh, I don't want that to happen again.
But sometimes you've got to remember that, you know, if you look at just average properties, I always remember this sort of stuck with me when I first went to the Property Investors Crash Course, which obviously Samuel runs. And he said, if you literally blindfolded anyone here, picked a random person, blindfolded you.
Get locked up for that.
Took you on a train, took you on a train station, put you on any train, you got off at any stop, blindfold still on. You were like, where's the nearest estate agent? They took you to the estate agent, this is right, you're at the window. You went, I want that one, please. And you pointed at a random house in a random city, you didn't know where you were, you're absolute newbie. That would probably still be a good investment over time.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, yeah.
It'd probably still go up in value,
yeah, you'd be able to do something with it, wouldn't you?
You would. Now, to be fair, when he said this, interest rates were a little bit lower, so you'd have probably made good cash flow from it as well. Mm-hmm. Maybe not so much right this second, although that is changing kind of as we speak.
Yeah.
But basically, any property you buy is going to be good. Now, here's the thing, though. The biggest mistake you can make is actually not buying the property. Because if you, let's say you wait a year trying to find the perfect deal, you've lost out on a year's worth of rent.
Yeah.
You've lost out on a year's worth of capital appreciation.
Yeah.
You know, all the time you could be making money, putting your money to work. Instead, it's shrinking in the bank.
Yeah. We see this happen regularly, don't we, with people? Waiting for the right time to invest in property. When's that?
Well, the best time was 20 years ago.
Exactly.
The second best time is right now.
Yeah.
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 So don't be too cautious. Now, we're going to cover the opposite of that later on in the show. But the first thing is, if you've done your due diligence and you know, don't be messing around. Oh no, there's this problem, there's that problem. Just do it.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, not only will you start making money from it straight away, but you'll learn from other mistakes that you've made and stuff as you go. Whereas if you don't take any action,
every day is a school day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think when you get so far into a deal that even if it's not the most lucrative deal, you're going to make it work, or if it can, you're going to make it work. and you're going to learn yourself a lot along the way. Like I say, there's no better way of learning than actually doing.
Have you ever not bought a deal where you thought, oh, I messed up there?
Last year, HMO on the market, and it were next door but one to a HMO that gave me a 13,500% ROI.
13,500, that sounds quite a lot.
It is a lot. Technically it were infinite, but when we refinanced it, we left £186 in the deal, something like £186, and it cash flowed net around 24 grand a year, give or take a few. And when I worked it out, about 13,500% ROI we got. So anyway, next door but one came up for sale. Very similar money, same house, as good as it's a row of terraced houses. But this was the end terrace, so it was slightly bigger because it was a bit different shape. And I was like, yeah, we'll buy it. And then something else came up, a little bit bigger project. And I thought, I want that one actually. So then this deal, I gave it to my good wife's best friend who were trying to get into property.
Got it.
And I gave them this deal. They took us out for dinner just as a thank you. And they have made the same money off that I made off mine. And the deal that I let it go for fell through. So then I was watching them build this house thinking, why didn't I just take that deal?
Yeah.
I knew it worked. I knew we could have made money. And then I took a risk to try and get a little bit of bigger house and it fell through. It all fell through.
So maybe you were too cautious and you should have just gone for both deals. Both,
exactly. Yeah. 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 I mean, I've overlapped multiple projects before, but we just wanted a little bit of a breather because we'd just come out of like three. So we're like, well, that's just a one this time and then try and do a bigger one.
Yeah.
So that was the reason why we went to go for the bigger one, which would have been like a 12-bed HMO. And that fell through due to planning. And then by that point, they'd already started the refurb on this house that I knew were going to work. And now it's finished and fully tenanted and competing with my HMO next door but one.
Yeah, crazy. Well, the thing is, even if it wasn't like the best deal in the world, I bet you've never looked back at a deal and gone, oh, we stretched ourselves too thin doing that. You know, you never do. You always look back and go, oh, it's well worth it.
Yeah.
Look back at the stuff you bought. Yeah, so happy I did. Yeah. So, yeah. Number one, too cautious, definitely. And obviously, James, like we said, the master of making mistakes. number two, and this is kind of the opposite now, this is another trait. This will depend on the sort of person that you are, right? So if you're, some people are perfectionists, and they want to get the perfect deal, number one will have hit them really hard. A lot of other people will fall into this trap of being too optimistic.
Mm.
Do you know those people that always think they've found the perfect deal?
Yes, I think you see this more regular than the other one, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
Me personally, I'm not that guy. I'm a bit of a pessimist when it comes to the deals, looking for a perfect deal. But yeah, I've seen this happen a lot where people like are stretching the numbers straight away and you think, nah. Yeah. That's not right.
They're like, oh, it would easy rent out for, you know, £2,000 a month. You're like, really?
Yeah, 6-bed HMO conversion, £30,000 refurb. Sure.
Yeah. I'll have it valued. It'll be worth $1 million. Yeah. It'll be worth $1 million. How much is it today? £100,000. How much are you planning on spending on it? Oh, there, 10, 15. Lick of paint.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the lenders will accept that.
Yeah. So a lot of people are very optimistic. And in particular, I find in three ways. Way number one is they think the property will be worth more than it would.
Mm.
Number two is they think the works, kind of touched on this, but the works will be cheaper than they will. And number three is they think they'll get more rent or a higher occupancy. Let's say they're doing a service accommodation. They're like, they get the absolute top whack rent and then work it out at 90% occupancy or something.
With no cleaning fees.
With no cleaning fees. Yeah, they forget about, no, stamp duty. What's stamp duty?
You know, booking fees, what are they?
Yeah, so you always want to be doing things like taking into consideration voids, taking into consideration maintenance.
Yeah.
You know, things like these, which it sounds like, it sounds silly, but are we allowed 10% for both of those? Well, if you're making 20% profit, that's your profit gone. You know, so it's taking these things into consideration.
This is especially important when you're doing a joint venture as well, I think, because especially if you are doing the work and the investor's putting the cash in and you're playing with somebody else's cash, you've got to be super, super realistic with them numbers. And I think if you overpromise an investor, even if it's still cash flowing good and they'd have accepted them numbers at day one, if you promise something else and that doesn't happen, they're always going to think,
Or if you're selling the deal, it's like, it's a good deal without the exaggeration, mate. You didn't need to exaggerate. Yeah.
When I first started, I did that.
What's over-exaggerated?
Slightly on some numbers. And then I rung the investor up. And then I went back to him and he says, you know what? He says, if you'd have given me them numbers originally, I'd have bought the deal. He says, but I've lost trust in you now. And that were a hard lesson to learn.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. So again, we're learning from James's mistakes.
I only make the mistake once though.
That's good. Well, that's the key is.
Yeah.
Right, we're so afraid of making mistakes. Mistakes are fine as long as you learn from
it. Yeah, definitely.
Number three is not doing proper due diligence. How many people don't do their proper due diligence when they're buying a deal?
Yeah. You see, again, you see this a lot where the numbers, their outgoings a year, you know, they've missed the council tax, they've missed the licensing, they've missed the cleaning fees, they've underestimated the gas, they've not looked at what prices properties are fetching on that street. Mm. They've looked at 3 miles away. And you'll know yourself, we can drive 3 miles down road and it's a completely different area. The house might be the same style and size, but the value is completely different.
Yeah, they've cherry-picked the ones that are worth a lot nearby to give them this inflated end value.
Yeah, and this all goes back to over-promising as well, doesn't it, in some ways?
Yeah.
But
or it could even be just as simple as there's stuff wrong with the property that you weren't aware of, right? So it's doing your proper due diligence on the property, why the person's selling. Mm. You don't want to be left with a lemon, especially if you're buying from auction.
Yeah, I don't like auction.
So have you, give us an example of a time where you didn't do your proper due diligence.
I wouldn't say I've got a time on that one. I think that's a
mistake. I'm sure you will.
No. I think...
I'm pretty sure I remember you telling me about a roof that you didn't notice.
The only one I would say comes close is one that we spent money on doing plans for. It were a large HMO. We were buying a big detached house. It were falling to bits. Not falling down, technically, but it were falling to bits. So we knew it needed a high refurb. We paid for plans from the architect doing. He started to submit planning, because we were going to turn it into a 7 or 8 bed HMO. And then we got a surveyor out who found subsidence.
Mm.
And obviously subsidence.
So did you get it? You got it in the wrong order? You should have done the surveys first. So you didn't do your proper due diligence.
We were overconfident on it.
Yeah.
We were like, this is definitely going to work, because it were good money. It were cheap. And we were like, don't matter what it needs, you know, if we have to do everything, it's fine. We're going to earn money off this one. Plus that we were going to get planning permission to build another house at the side, which we would have got. It were a big enough plot. So we'd got a big cushion with that, because we knew there were about 70 to 80 grand profit in that.
On the land.
Yeah. But then by the time we'd done looking at the subsidence issue and things, it were eating into them profits. And then if we'd have only made 60 grand on that house, we'd have been even further down. So we then had to swallow the big pill of losing about two and a half grand to come away from it.
Yeah.
So
you did do your due diligence, you just didn't do it probably when you should.
In the right order.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should have got the survey done first.
So can we still kick that down as a James mistake for not doing your due diligence?
I'm sure I called you about that, Russell, and asked you what to do, and you said just get planning on it first.
I don't remember this conversation. Doesn't sound like the sort of thing I'd say. So 3 out of 3. All right. Here's a big one, especially right now, because the market's been so stable for so long. Number four, getting caught out when the market changes. Now, the markets obviously can drastically change.
It has been stable for long, hasn't it?
Been stable for like, since what, 2008? Well, sort of after that, I don't know when it sort of stabilised. Well,
I'd say it's gone up, obviously, a little since then, hasn't it? But there's been no drastic changes recently.
Well, the big one, obviously, up until the mortgage changes, right? So all these people have got buy-to-lets. But it also could be law. I tell you, there's two I can think of where people have been caught out badly. The first one was when they changed the law so you couldn't count your mortgage interest as a...
Section
24.
24, yeah.
So where you couldn't count your mortgage interest as...
If it's in your own name.
If it's in your own name. So you've got all these landlords that have got properties that are... it'll be you one of them.
First one I bought before I got trained.
Okay, there you go. So you've got all these landlords, another mistake. So you've got, all these landlords that have got these properties in their personal name. Suddenly Section 24 comes out and bang, they're actually losing money all of a sudden. So the market's changed and they weren't...
We didn't lose money.
Well, you could lose money.
But we lost a little bit of profit. Yeah.
But you could literally be...
If it had been a single buy to let, we would have definitely lost money.
Yeah?
Yeah. So there's a lot of landlords out there being nailed with that.
100%. So, but and then the other one where it's changed, and I almost feel like the first one, to be fair, it was hard to prepare for that one. I mean, like the government have changed the legislation. If you didn't know, you didn't. How could you prepare for it? But one where I think people got caught out and they should have prepared for it was the interest rates going up.
Yeah, I mean, it were obvious they were going to go up. They could only go one way, you know, unless banks started giving us money to buy houses. Did it go down to 0.25% the base rate at one point?
Something like that. It's very low,
0.25, weren't it? So it were always going to go one way. So yeah, I think people who've over-leveraged at that point and not fixed in long enough, they deserve what they get.
See, the thing is, though, I kind of respect people that use leverage a lot. But you're right.
I use leverage, yeah, but...
You don't want to over-leverage.
No, I mean, all my deals I'm looking at, that realistically, if the base rate went up to 10%, I'd still be in the green, just.
Mm.
But you've got to have some cushion on it, haven't you? I think that people who've leveraged the debt and pulled 75% out when it were at 0.5%, 0.25%, and they've just hoped that it's going to stay at that. It's not, is it? I mean, what are we at now? Is it gone down a 5% a minute, the base rate?
5.25.
I thought it had dropped from that to 5. No.
Has it dropped? Yeah, it might have done, actually. Yeah, 5.25 to 5. Yeah. But it's going to come down, you're right. It's going to come down again to 4.75. They predict by the end of this year.
But then my mortgage broker were predicting it were going to go back up. Obviously, nobody knows, do they?
No.
But I think you've got to leave enough meat on the bones that as it fluctuates up and down a little bit.
I tell you what I think we do know, though. I think I would be absolutely stunned if over the next 3 to 5 years it's not significantly lower than it is now.
Hope so.
I'd be shocked if it's not.
What do you think it'll settle at?
I don't know. But I think it's going to come down to, I think, at least half over the next 3 to 5 years.
Hmm.
I think it's going to seriously come down. And one of the reasons I think that is because that if you fix your mortgages on a longer-term rate, it's cheaper than a short-term rate.
Yeah.
Which indicates, bear in mind, they don't want to give you really cheap mortgages for a long time if the interest rates are going to go up.
Yeah.
Right? So normally it's the way around.
Yeah.
It's been so cheap because I think it might go up. Now
this started happening about 8 months ago, didn't it? Just less than a year ago, where they were changing around.
It was about
5 years
ago,
and 2 years.
Because
I remember we were going to refinance one, and when he sent me products through, I was like, why is it cheaper to fix for 5 years? And he was like, well, why do you think?
Because it's coming down.
Ah, it's going to come down.
Yeah.
We still fix for 5 years.
We did as well. I tell you why. I tell you why I did, though.
You sleep better, don't you? If it's earning money. And
it's earning money at that rate, I'm thinking... 5 years, because it could in the meantime...
I may be dead in 5 years.
Nah.
So at least I'm earning some money for the next 5 years.
Exactly that. So getting caught out when it changes, interest rates in particular, maybe new legislation, keeping an eye. So for example, I'll give you another example of something else that might change. It's keeping an eye on it and being aware. New legislation might come out for serviced accommodation units. Mm. So don't be shocked. Don't wait for it to come out, because they always give you warning. It's not like it suddenly happens and there's nothing you can do. They're talking about it now.
They've been talking about it for a while, haven't they?
Yeah, keep an eye on it and see what.
Yeah.
And make sure that you're set up. So if you've got units, in fact, let's move on to the next one. It kind of links. Number five, No exit strategy. Always have a plan B. So let's say you're renting out a serviced accommodation. You're buying something for serviced accommodation. I would want to know when I bought that, it also worked as a buy-to-let.
I think the lenders would as well, wouldn't they? Because the lenders are not daft.
They would if you're buying it with a mortgage.
Yeah.
What about if you're buying it with bridging?
Well, bridging, they'll let you buy anything, wouldn't they?
What about if you're buying, it's your first property and you're buying it to live in yourself?
To live in yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got to have a plan B with it, haven't you? And if you're not going to at least break even plus a little bit of profit as a single let, then maybe you need to rethink that deal.
Yeah, or it might be that they turn around to you with the stress test and they go, well, look, we'll lend to you, but you need to put more in. And you go, yeah, all right, that's fine. I've got the money, I'll put it in. But it's like, if they're worried, you should be worried.
Yeah.
I always think that, you know, people that are trying to lie to the mortgage brokers or whatever to try and fit it.
Yeah.
And it's like, if they're concerned,
yeah,
you should be concerned. They're concerned. They're not concerned just for the hell of it. They're concerned because they think if this doesn't work as service accommodation, then we need to make sure it works as a buy-to-let. And if you're like, oh no, but it will work as a have a plan B.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't want to be sort of so over leveraged. Going back to our previous point, that you have to sell stuff. It's like, oh, I have to sell this now because now I'm losing money on this, and I'm like, oh, I'm stuck and I can't. You know, you want to be in a situation where, you know, you're not planning to fail, but if it doesn't go exactly to plan,
yeah, you need a plan B.
What's your plan B?
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that definitely. We've got some serviced accommodation units, and I know the property would work as a single let, but hopefully, if they do bring some planning legislation out, there's going to be some sort of grandfather rights that we can claim
for service accommodation.
Yeah,
well, that's what they've said.
Yeah, so like obviously we Article 4, we HMOs, as long as you can prove historical use. So they're doing something with a tax with that as well at the minute, aren't they?
With which one?
With serviced accommodation. I think I saw something recently. I don't know if it was just one local council that's trialled it or a few, where you had to prove that you got 180 days worth of use for them to give you the different tax, not council tax, what's
business
it called?
Rights.
Business rates. Yeah, to prove that you'd got business rates. So you had to get, like, you had to prove that you'd let it out for 100, it might have been 186 days or something. And then they'd allow you to claim business rates.
Yeah, because you can collect, obviously it's cheaper often than the council tax. True. So yeah, it does make sense if you can.
Yeah, so it just makes me wonder if they're going to do that with the, if they C5 it. So they might say, yeah, we'll let you turn it to C5. But we need to show that you need to show us that it's actually working as a serviced accommodation.
Yeah.
Well, which 186 days is not much to prove, is it?
They haven't given us any sort of definition. The only thing that they've said right now is if its sole purpose is serviced accommodation, you can change the class.
Yeah.
Under grandfather rights. Yeah. But that was Conservatives. Labour in now, who knows? They might rewrite the rule book completely. And none of this has actually happened yet. It's all talk. It might be 5 years before this comes in.
I think we'll be 5 years before anything happens.
Do you?
Yeah.
I don't think
no, it's even gone in as white paper yet in Parliament, has it?
I think it will come in sooner than that.
You think?
Because I think that Labour are really on this sort of stuff. But you might be right. And I don't know. It's purely a guess. All right, number six. This is a mistake. I've never made this mistake, and I would hope, to be fair, James, that you've never made this mistake, but you might surprise me. But this is a
only
mistake.
Only once, if I have.
I see all the time. And I think the only reason I didn't make this mistake, actually, was because of my previous business experience. So if you're new to business, this is a mistake that so
I hope
many
I am now, because I've previous business experience.
Make.
So.
Well, I bet you didn't make this mistake. And it's jumping into a joint venture without clarity.
No.
You've not done that?
No, I've not. And I've done a few joint ventures. That said, I also tell people when they ask me about doing joint ventures, because I've done quite a few now, and they're always structured slightly different depending on what you and the investor want.
But can I ask you a question before you go into it?
Mm.
Right. The first way I think you probably won't have messed up by the fact you've done quite a few joint ventures. A lot of people, they set up joint ventures where it's kind of like, oh yeah, we're just doing serviced accommodation together. Mm. And it's like, who's doing what? We're just doing it together.
Yeah, we'll decide that down the line.
Yeah, so how many units have you got? We've got three units. How are you getting on with them? They're quite lazy, actually. They're not really doing anything. You're an idiot.
Yeah.
You're an idiot. The only way I would recommend doing joint ventures to begin with is on a deal-by-deal basis. So let's say we were going to buy... That's the only way I've ever done joint ventures. It's like, look, we'll buy this property together. You're bringing XYZ to the table.
Yeah.
I'm bringing ABC to the table. It could be money or whatever it is. We'll draw up a contract for this deal and this deal only. Yeah. And then that is it.
Anything else outside of that doesn't count.
No, we do all our own stuff, right? Yeah. Outside of that, it's completely...
Yeah, that's exactly how I'll do it. I mean, one of my investors, we've done three good-sized deals together and we've got three contracts. Each, the second contract refers back to the first contract and the third to the second.
So every time you do a deal with them, it's a new contract?
Yes. Yeah. And we just put that property in. We, again, say, well, who's doing X, Y, Z, who's doing ABC? And then that way there's no arguments.
Yeah.
But I do believe as well that no matter what you put in that contract, you can cover probably 99.9% of eventualities. But there's always a chance that something's going to crop up that you've not put in the contract, especially when you're new into it, when you're both new into it.
But another thing you should put into it, I mean, it's a bit different if you're buying a property together because it's very different. But if you were to, let's say, do rent-to-rents, for example, or something, especially when it's a business-related deal, what's your exit strategy? And that's another thing that no one puts in. So if... And now is the time to decide, right? Now is the time. So if, for example, let's say me and you teamed up to do rent-to-rents. If after a year... I turn around to you and said, I don't want to work with you anymore. I just don't like you. You're a bit of a dick, right? Let's say, for example...
Ouch, man.
You keep making mistakes, right? Let's say. What happens now? Because by the time I've got to the point where I'm so fed up with you that I've had to turn around and say that, we're not going to have a reasonable conversation.
Exactly,
at this point,
Right? We're then referring back to the contract, and if there's nothing in the contract, we're then just knocking on wood.
Yeah. So one of my favourite ones is what we call a push and pull agreement. So how that works is if I'm the one that wants out, I will turn around to you and I will offer to buy you out. But here's the deal. When I offer to buy you out, you can either accept my offer or you can buy me out for the amount that I offered to buy you out.
I've heard of this before.
Right. So it means I'm not going to turn around and go, I'll give you
I'll give you 50 quid.
Because it's like...
And then if I then said... No, but I will buy you out. Have you legally then got to accept regardless?
That's what the contract says. Yeah. So I've got to put it to you in writing, my offer, and then you've got 7 days to think about it. And then you let me know which way you want to go with it. And that is it.
That's good. I mean, I think we've put in ours that if we decided to sell, that we can't sell until the cash investor has made back a minimum, or should I say, I can't request a sell until the cash investor has done a minimum of doubled their money. Meaning if they've put 150 grand into a deal, until they've made 300 grand back, I can't even say, I want to sell it. And then after that, we then, if one of us wants to sell and the other don't, we either have to buy each other out or we have to just sell if we don't agree. But I like that idea.
Yeah.
That's good.
It's good, isn't it? Do you know what it reminds me when I was kids, me and Samuel. So like if there was like one biscuit left, my mom used to have the rule. She'd go, right, Russell, you break it in half. And then Samuel, you get to pick which half. So when I'm breaking the biscuit in half, right, I'm trying to make it
exact.
As possible. So that when he picks, it's like, oh, there's no difference to that one. Because if I mess it up, if I break it and it's like, oh, no. Oh, no, that's the 60% of that is. I know for what he's going to
You were getting 60%. The smart bit, yeah.
Exactly.
So. Yeah, your mum's smart. You should let her do your business deal.
I should get her in as a mentor or something.
Definitely.
Yeah, it should be. That would be good. All right. So, yeah, joint ventures, though. We obviously run PIMS, Property Investors Mediation Service. Nearly all of the problems, with the issues between people...
Are joint ventures.
It's joint ventures where, guess what?
No contract.
Not got a contract.
Yeah.
Get a contract. Get clarity.
They've had a few wines at night and they've come up with a great idea.
They meet
and
a networking
best pals. We're best pals.
But are you best pals when it all goes wrong? If you are, even if you're friends. When I went into business with Samuel, we spent months going back and forth, doing the contract, who's going to do what. Months.
You don't know what's around the corner, do you?
Exactly.
You might be best friends this week and then next week, you're sworn enemies.
I hope not, but maybe. Either.
I'm taking Samuel's side.
Number seven. This is a big one. It's similar to trying to find the perfect property, but just not taking action, not looking for deals, not
being
procrastinating,
lazy.
Just being lazy. Yeah, the amount of people I see that are interested. Oh yeah, I want to do property. Yeah.
I think these people just don't really want it. They like to think they do. They come to the seminars. They see, you know, they like to talk about property. They post it on their Instagram, but they're not actually making any moves. They're either lazy or they're scared.
Do you know what I think it is? I think most procrastination, if they're coming to the seminars and stuff, I think they're probably not lazy. They probably do want it.
Mm.
I think most people procrastinate because they don't know what they should do. I think it's
guidance.
It's a lack. It's. Do you know, you'll know this, right? When you've got work to do, I bet you if you've got a list, you've got some emails to go through, you've got some things, the bit the things that you put off the most are the things where it's a challenge. You don't actually know what...
Actually, because of your mum, I don't do that anymore.
Okay.
Your mum recommended a book to me called Eat That Frog by Brian Tracy. And it's all about like procrastination and basically making lists.
Mm.
And it refers back to Eat That Frog is basically...
Do something horrible that you don't want to do. Do the horrible stuff first.
And I always think about that book. So I've got like, I've got a whiteboard at home and I put all my tasks on that I need to do. Everything. Not like massive tasks, but just day-to-day tasks.
Like go to the loo.
Yeah.
Fix the plumbing on
the
toilet.
Fix the toilet flush button in Samuel's house. Things like that.
It's like a normal thing to
and
have.
And then I'll rate it, which is high, low, medium priorities.
Yeah.
And I will always start with the highs, especially the worst one I don't want to do.
So you'll start
so your
with the highest
easier.
Priority.
Yes.
Not necessarily the hardest task.
Usually I will go with the hardest task, definitely. But I will only put maybe a day's worth of high priority tasks on. I'll not like put that's high, that's high, that's high. I'm like, right, what's high today? So this has got to get done, that's got to get done. And then I'm on them. So then your day gets easier because as you get tired throughout the day, you don't then, if you wouldn't want to do them tasks first thing in the morning.
You ain't going to want to do them later.
You're not going to do them later, are you?
So do you not make that mistake anymore?
I've never made that mistake.
But hold on. But you said that
I would say,
speaking to my mom and reading Eat That Frog, you changed, completely revolutionised the way that you...
I would never say I were a massive procrastinator, but yeah. I would be one that would like to... I'd look at the tasks and I'd think, that's a nice easy task, I'll do that. That's a nice easy task, I'll do that. And then it'd get to end of the day and then I'd have the big task to do. And I'd still do them, but then when you're tired and then you finish the day on a negative because you're like, oh, I didn't want to do that. Why am I doing this? But then when you do it the other way around, and then you finish on the nice, easy tasks, and then you look at your board and it's wiped off, because there's no better feeling for me. I know it sounds a little bit sad, but my whiteboard, I've got a little rubber, a magnetic rubber to it, and when I've done a task and I wipe it off, it just gives me that nice feeling inside. I think that's gone. I don't ever have to look at that again, depending on what it is, obviously.
Yeah.
And then as I go on the day and I break it down...
Makes you feel a little warm and fuzzy inside.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah. Thank you, Mrs. Leeds.
That's good. So he used to make mistakes too, but he's learned over time and now he doesn't. Do you know another reason I think people procrastinate? I think people are scared of, they don't want to make mistakes.
Scared of failure.
Scared of failure. And if
some
you don't,
scared of success.
Some people are scared of success.
I was scared of success when I first started.
Go on, tell me about that.
Because when you become successful, you inevitably change. And I liked the person I was before.
Really?
Yeah, believe it or not. And you see less of your old friends, family as well. And then the more successful you get, you inevitably start moving in different circles.
Oh, I just can't relate to that at all.
Because you were born with a silver spoon in your mouth, Russell. But it scared me a little bit, success.
Really?
I always knew I was going to be successful, always.
But it scared you? What? I don't understand that.
But I kind of like, I think I held back from it for a while because I liked where I was. I got a good life, we got decent money, we got good friends and, you know,
but
I got more bikes.
Why would you not want more success? Nice house.
I do know. Now that I've opened that gate, it's just snowballing now. But it took me a long time to open that gate. I was like early 30s before I realised, what am I doing? Laid under somebody's toilet, fixing it for £60 an hour. I was just like, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
And then I just thought, right, now it's time to go. And you just have to let go of that person who you used to be, I'm afraid.
Yeah. See, I don't even think I've changed, though. I don't feel that, like, as I've become more successful, I'm still the exact same person. I don't feel like
I've
changed.
You were born smart, though. I had to get smart.
Okay.
There's a compliment in there somewhere.
Sounds like it, yeah. A minute ago, I was born with a silver spoon on my Warsaw council estate.
Mind you,
do you know what? I was gonna go, mate, a silver spoon. I was born, I lived in a house with no carpets, Warsaw council estate. Yeah. And then I remembered that you're from Barnsley.
Exactly.
So I probably, in comparison,
yeah, you were a billionaire.
It's all relative. talking of being scared of making mistakes, though, and scared of failure. I think a lot of people are scared of failure. I actually think failure is a really good thing.
Yeah.
And that proves
you only make that mistake once, usually, unless you're an idiot.
Number eight, not learning from mistakes. Mm. If you're making mistakes, I think it's interesting because I've read lots of books actually about how when you fail, that's how you get good. It's by making mistakes. That's the learning. As long as you do it in the right way, when you make mistakes and you learn, and you're like, okay, so like, even look at any inventor.
You do have to minimize these mistakes, though.
Do you? What about Thomas Edison? How many failures did he have to create the light bulb?
Was it about 1,100?
Something ridiculous, wasn't it? Every time he made a mistake. There's a brilliant book actually about this I'm going to recommend to you, James.
Okay.
It's going to change your life even more than Eat That Frog.
Okay.
It's called Black Box Thinking.
Black Box Thinking.
Right, it's by a guy called Matthew Syed, and I love his books. He's also written a brilliant book called Bounce. But Matthew Syed, Black Box Thinking, and basically what it's about is this. On aeroplanes, making a mistake, pretty costly. Right. If you make a mistake on an aeroplane, you're in a lot of trouble, right? So they have a black box that records everything.
Right? And then they learn from that mistake at a heavy cost.
Any issues with the flight, any problems, it's like, let's analyze in detail. Why did that happen? Why did we make a mistake? Mm. There's not a point the finger. There's not a blame game society. It's just like, how can we learn from this for the future? They look at it, they analyze it, they go, right, maybe we try this, maybe we try that. And they experiment. And they, through experimentation and science, they improve. And as a result, airlines have become one of the safest modes of transport on the planet because every mistake is analyzed and new systems are brought in to stop it from happening again.
Yeah.
Compare that with something like the NHS, right? I can't remember the stats, but they talk about it in the book, but the amount of people that die from mistakes made by the NHS is astronomical, right? They make loads of mistakes. When they make a mistake,
they don't admit fault.
They cover it up.
Yep.
They don't learn from it.
Mm.
So obviously making mistakes is not good, but if you've got like a scientific, analytical mind to, okay, that didn't work. Why did that not work? And you analyse it, you will learn, you'll grow so much. So
you're saying I've got a scientific mind then, because the mistakes I've made, I've only made once.
Well, yeah. I think you have. You must have. You're probably not even thinking about it, but your natural smart that you've learned. okay, I messed up there.
Yeah.
How can I not let that happen?
But
again?
I do think you need to minimise them to start with. There were mistakes that I've made throughout my property investing career that I definitely could have avoided easily. But you don't know what you don't know, do you?
No.
You don't know what questions to ask when you're new.
You don't.
It's like people who say, well, all the information's out there for free. Yeah, it is, but if you don't even know what question to ask to get to that information.
And the problem is, while a lot of the information is there out for free, there's also
a lot of shit.
A lot of misinformation.
Yes.
We're living in a world now of like misinformation and overinformation. Mm. There's too much information. So finding the nuggets is like finding a needle in a haystack.
Yeah.
Which brings us on to our next point, nicely. Not seeking professional advice. Trying to do everything on your own.
What kind of professionals?
I'd say lots of professionals. So I would say, number one, property trainers.
Yeah.
Like what we've both
totally
paid
agree,
for property training. But number two, I would say you want to use solicitors when you draw up a contract. You don't use a solicitor for your contract.
I use them, but I will instruct them. I'm very anti-solicitor.
You want to use an accountant for your tax advice. You want to go and speak to a tax saver, tax accountant. You want to make the most. You want to use a mortgage broker. Don't just go and get a mortgage from your bank. Speak to a broker that can find you the best deal.
A good broker.
You want to be using these people that should be in your power team.
you've got to have a power team like this, yeah. But then again, I think you should also know 80% of their job. You should know what the stages are that they have to do.
You should know that. I always think that you should know enough to have an intelligent conversation with them, right?
Agreed.
So like when I'm speaking to my tax advisor or my accountants, I can throw idea. I need to know enough that I can throw an idea at them. Could we try it like this? Could we structure it like this? But then I'll bow to their superior knowledge if they're like, no, you can't. Oh, yes, you can. Okay, great. Mm. But you want to be able to argue the toss. You want to be able to look at things from you. Because at the end of the day, no one cares about your business like you care about your business.
Correct.
So if you just outsource it, it was what I used to do when I first set up my business. It was like literally put all my receipts into a paper bag, go and dump them at my accountant's door and go.
I only stopped doing that last year.
Did you? And go, sort it, right?
Yeah.
It's like,
that's your job,
man. Sand. A lot of people do it with marketing. If they hire a marketing person, just sort my marketing.
Yeah.
Here you go, agency.
Here's 3,000 photos. Pick the best one.
Yeah, or even not. Just use AI. Put it on ChatGPT. Right, but you want to be aware. You want to be able to have an intelligent conversation. You
yeah.
want to know what the KPIs are. You want to be able to yeah. hold them to account. But you still need the expert. You still need the professionals
yeah.
to help you.
Sadly,
you.
Yeah. As much as our slate solicitors, we do need them, don't we?
Well, unfortunately, we do.
Yeah, and they do. They do get the job done eventually.
They're definitely slow.
Yeah.
But if you know the job, like you're saying, if you know enough to have an intelligent conversation with them. If they're being slow, then you know, hey, you're being slow here. This should take
yeah.
this long.
And
this should be the process.
I think as you progress as well with your own knowledge in them areas, generally and usually you'll get new power teams.
Yeah.
Because like when I think back to when I first started, my power team were not very powerful. It was just a team of idiots. Whereas now I've like, because now I know what the process is and probably 80% of what their job is anyway, I then could make a decision and think that person's not right for where I'm going. So I've had to let them go.
Yeah.
I mean, I am on my fourth, maybe fifth accountant now.
How many solicitors?
Probably about the same.
Yeah,
maybe you're the idiot.
Maybe
it's me. Yeah, it's me.
Do you know, like when someone thinks everyone's
yeah,
a dick,
everybody like, else,
everyone I meet's a dick.
The solicitor I've got at minute, to be fair, is decent. He's a little bit slow, but he's 63, I think. So,
do you think that's old?
He's an old 63. I hope he's not watching this. But he's an old 63.
Just say this was filmed like 2 years ago. that was solicitor number four.
Yeah, but no, I've got a good team behind me now. I wouldn't change them, who I've got. And it's very important to have them knowing what your goals are and where you're going, because they can make things very easy for you or very difficult.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. So yeah, so what is possible to learn a lot on your own, get them advice from professionals can help. And like we mentioned earlier, learning from their mistakes as well, and educating yourself, you know, and doing your proper due diligence. Mm. And then number 10, this is the final one. We've made it through the first nine.
And I've made two mistakes up to now.
I don't think you'll have made this mistake, but this is a mistake you'll see an awful lot.
Okay.
And especially with property. And I think the reason is, because I think a lot of people get into property and their attitude is passive income, really easy. And they don't do this, which is treat it as a business.
Because
you've got to remember, property investing, it is a business. And while you can create a passive income, the setup process, learning how to do it correctly, how actually investing correctly, it's a business. You've got to treat it as a business. You need to look at your systems. You need to be professional when you're dealing with your tenants or your agencies or whatever it is. You've got to treat it as a business. Don't just think, oh yeah, it's passive income, a little side hustle. I hate the word side hustle, actually. I don't know what you think of side hustle.
Yeah, it's not a side hustle, is it? It's, I mean, even if you try and treat it as a side hustle to start with, especially if you're doing it properly, it just engulfs your life, doesn't it, property investing?
Yeah.
I don't think anybody can be massively successful in property and do it as a side hustle. And if they are, they're not reaching the potential. But I think everybody originally makes that mistake of not treating it like a business and not outsourcing things and not having the right team behind them. Obviously, a big one to start with is cost. You know, you can't afford to always get people doing the little day-to-day tasks for you that really you shouldn't be doing. But to start with, you've got to do, haven't you? Because
yeah, of course.
You've got to get involved in every aspect of the business to start with. One, even just to know how it actually works. Because you can't just like, right, I'm going to be a property investor. Here's my team. I'm going to set a PA on at 28 grand a year. I'm going to set a management team up that's going to look after this. And you've got no real income. You've got to get involved in it all. But I think as the business grows, if you don't then start treating it like a business and stepping back from things. I think one of the hardest things for me was when I had to just realize and accept that nobody, like you said earlier, nobody's going to do a task in your business as well as you would.
No one's going to care as much as you.
Yeah. Because it's not their business. They're an employee. And you've got to remember that. Like when I used to be a gas plumber, I went through like probably I had 3 or 4 apprentices in space of 3 or 4 years because I was like, they just don't care, these apprentices. They're just, the van's messy and they're not putting shoe covers on when we go in the house. But I didn't realise then that actually they're not that bothered.
Nah.
They're just an employee. It was my business.
Well, they're there just to really learn from you.
Yeah.
They're probably in as easy as possible. Just want to get qualified.
Yeah.
They don't give a toss about you or your business, really.
Yeah.
Have you ever not been self-employed? Did you ever work as an apprentice?
Yes. I was an apprentice for a local council.
For a local council?
When I first started, yeah.
And I bet
I was a dick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can imagine. You haven't changed a bit, have you?
No. When I think back, I mean, people used to say that to me when I was complaining about my apprentices and they were like, this is karma coming back to you. And I was like, yeah. And I used to say, yeah, but I wouldn't employ somebody like I was at 17.
Yeah, but you probably would if you were paying them £3 an hour.
Yeah. But yeah, I think as long as you start learning to step back from things and delegate it, if you want to grow, that is, you know, some people can get to 3, 4, 5 grand a month coming in. And they're working nearly every other day or every day. And they may be happy with that and think, well, I don't need to outsource anything because I've hit that 5 grand a month and
but even,
I'm happy
even then,
here.
Though, you should still treat it as a business. You should still put the time, the effort, the respect that it deserves. Even if you're not outsourcing, you know, loads of sole traders, they've still got to treat it as a business.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just a little flutter on the side. It's a business.
Yeah.
It needs the love, the effort, the work, the time.
This then goes back to people not taking action because I think you've got to decide. I don't see how anybody can do it as a side hustle. So you've got to decide if property's for you or not and if you want to do it full-time because it is a full-time job.
Yeah. And if you do it, it's one of the most lucrative, best professions you can
massively
get involved in.
There's some great days I have. There's some bad days as well, don't get me wrong. It's a difficult business to navigate. But I never, ever lay in bed at night and think, I wish I'd stayed plumbing.
No.
Never. It's the best thing I've ever done. But also one of the hardest things I've done. But I have scaled faster than you probably should, if I'm honest.
You can't scale too fast.
I need that yacht.
Yeah, exactly that. Well, guys, hope you enjoyed the show. They are the biggest 10 mistakes that beginner property investors, or not even beginner, general property investors tend to make. Hope you found that really useful. I've been Russell Leeds.
And I'm James Ewell.
And we'll see you next week.